A lot of people say to me, Doc, I don't need to take vitamins and minerals and trace minerals because I use herbs. Now, herbs are not nutrition. You have to understand that herbs are not nutrition. They are great plant medicines. They're safer, they're more economical, and in most cases are more effective than prescription medications that doctors will give you, but they're plant medicines. If you have diarrhea, they can tighten you up. If you have constipation, they can loosen you up. If you have hypertension or high blood pressure, they can bring it down. If you have a fever, they can bring it down. But don't expect to get enough calcium or selenium or boron or copper or vitamin A from herbs. I had another good friend by the name of Tommy Bass, and he was an expert on herbs, and he lived like Yul Gibbons up in the mountains out in the east and wrote many, many best-selling books on herbs. And he died at age 88, and a lot of people say, hey, that's pretty good. He lived 12 years longer than the average American. But you're going to see in a minute that that's only half of your genetic capability, your genetic capacity for longevity. And if Tommy Bass would have taken vitamins and minerals as well as the herbs, he'd probably still be alive today. There is no proof in the pudding that you can get enough nutrition from herbs. Then one of my favorites is this thing on salt. This is probably one of the bigger medical cacas, this salt thing. Doctors tell you, don't use salt, no sodium, because it's going to give you hypertension, high blood pressure, it'll give you heart disease, and they've made Americans paranoid about salt. Now, I'm a veterinarian as well as a physician, and I refuse to believe that my human patients are dumber than a cow. What's the first thing that a farmer or rancher puts out for his livestock? Big salt block, right? Nobody gives any restriction on a cow. She goes out and has all the salt she wants, never gets high blood pressure. And so I always used to tell my patients, look, let's use a little common sense here. Why don't you go ahead and take a salt shaker, just salt your food to taste, go mad with the salt. Your body will tell you when to back off. And 98% of my patients would do it just because I asked them to do it. And I've been vindicated in this belief. This was actually a study that was published in the New York Times, May 22, 1996. And this study was abstracted from JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the most prestigious medical journal in the world, according to themselves. Now, in this particular journal, a Dr. Alexander Gordon Logan, who's an epidemiologist and cardiologist on the teaching staff of the medical school at the University of Toronto up in Canada, and he took 56 existing studies on hypertension or high blood pressure and restriction of salt, combined the data from these 56 studies, which included 3,505 people. He threw away all the conclusions and reevaluated the larger group. And what he found out was this. If you have normal blood pressure and you restrict salt, it will not prevent you from getting heart disease or high blood pressure. If you have hypertension or high blood pressure and you restrict salt, 97% of those with high blood pressure or hypertension who restrict salt will not get any measurable benefit. 97% will not get any measurable benefit. Zero. 2-5% get measurable benefit, but it's not significant. They're only able to reduce their blood pressure by 3.7 millimeters of mercury. So here's what Dr. Alexander Gordon Logan said in JAMA, May 22, 1996. He said, you might as well go ahead and salt your food to taste. It's a meaningless exercise. Don't get paranoid about salt. It has nothing to do with blood pressure problems. There has never been one single iota of proof that restricting salt has any benefit. It's just one of those medical myths, he called it, but I'm going to call it a medical caca. Then there's the subject of nutrition. You know, the doctors always tell you, just eat your four food groups. You don't need vitamins and minerals and trace minerals. You can get everything you need. And again, from these medical journals and hospital journals, I got some great ads. These are from like the 1950s and 1962. I want you to read this. This is from a hospital journal. This is the Kellogg's Roundtable Topics for Hospital Staff. And you see there's a doctor and two nurses, or maybe a nurse and a dietitian. The purchasing agent, do Kellogg's cereals really save me money? The floor nurse, how can I save time in the morning? Dietitian, how do I get patients to eat breakfast or enjoy breakfast? Does it say anything in there about giving patients good nutrition? No. They're solving all these administrative problems with Kellogg's cereal, but nothing about nutrition. Then here's the creme de la creme of these advertisements. This is a hospital journal, okay? Hospital journal, Journal of the American Hospital Association. This is actually 1962. Coca-Cola, too, has its place in a well-balanced diet. As a pure and wholesome drink, it provides quick energy, brings you back refreshed after work or play. It contributes to good health by providing a pleasurable moment. That's the level of doctor's nutritional training. After 14 years in medical school, this is where they get their nutritional information from these ads in the hospital journals. My favorite disease is arthritis. I love arthritis. Now, the reason why I love arthritis is it's easy to fix. And when you can fix something as horrible and as debilitating, as painful and as expensive and as miserable as arthritis, you get kind of excited about this concept of preventing and curing diseases with nutrition. And so I tell people about this arthritis thing all the time. So let's have a quick look at arthritis. Number one, 75-80% of all Americans over the age of 50 get arthritis to one degree or of one type or another. And according to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, 35-50 million baby boomers are going to get arthritis in the next 7 to 10 years, and there's not a single medical treatment designed to prevent or fix it. Aspirin certainly doesn't fix arthritis, causes gastric bleeding and death. Tylenol doesn't fix arthritis, causes 50,000 cases of kidney failure each year, 5,000 of which are so severe you need a kidney transplant. Then there's ibuprofen, Advil, and Aleve. These things don't fix arthritis, and they cause liver disease in 2 to 5% of the users, including liver cirrhosis, even if you don't drink. And then there's methotrexate and gold shots. These things don't fix arthritis. They subdue your bone marrow so you can't make normal platelets and white blood cells. And then you have the granddaddies of all the medical treatments for arthritis, prednisone and cortisone. They don't fix arthritis. They subdue your immune system, which leaves you open to diseases far, far more horrible than arthritis. And prednisone and cortisone accelerate the loss of minerals from your bones, something you don't want when you have osteoporosis and arthritis. Now, when these prescription medications and over-the-counter medications don't work anymore to relieve pain and inflammation, the only thing left for you medically is joint replacement surgery. And I never like to send my patients in for the joint replacement surgery because they never work out well. In fact, many times you're worse off after the surgery than you were before the surgery. The advantage my patients have always had is that I'm a veterinarian as well as a physician. And so I always used to tell my patients, look, we have all these nutritional formulas designed to prevent and cure diseases in animals, including arthritis. And so I tried adapting nutritional arthritis formulas designed to prevent and cure arthritis in pigeons and turkeys, dogs, cats, sheep, pigs, horses, cows, lions, tigers, and bears to human use. And it was no surprise to me. It works just as well in humans as it does in animals because it was designed to prevent and cure arthritis in pigs. And I've literally seen tens of thousands of people who've had a regrowth of cartilage, ligaments, tendons, connective tissue, bone foundation, bone matrix. Doesn't matter if they're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. I've seen people 97 years old regrow cartilage and bone, even if they had bone-to-bone arthritis. If there's blood supply to that joint and that bone, they will regrow bone and cartilage. Well, of course, Harvard Medical School goes berserk when you say stuff like that. Wallach, you can't say those things. The only thing left for people when they get bone-to-bone arthritis is joint replacement surgery. And I'd agree with them if the only raw materials you're using is Tylenol and aspirin and prednisone and cortisone. We've learned over 50 years that you can't regrow cartilage and bone using those things. One of the basic things, of course, that the Harvard Medical School jumped onto, and they said, this is so ridiculous that this couldn't work. And so they took 29 patients, arthritis patients, who had failed to respond in any way to heroic medical treatment for arthritis over 15 to 20 years. They took them off all their medication, wasn't working for them anyway, lined them up for joint replacement surgery, and they said, look, for 90 days before we do the surgery, they gave them a heaping tablespoonful of ground up chicken cartilage and their orange juice every morning for 90 days. They were sort of chuckling in their beer saying nothing's gonna happen. Well, here's what happened. In 10 days, these 29 people had complete relief of pain and inflammation, something they hadn't had in 15 to 20 years. In 30 days, they could now open up a new pickle jar that had never been opened without pain to the fingers, wrists, elbows, and shoulders. In 90 days, 28 of the 29 were clinically cured. Now, this is from Harvard Medical School in the Boston VA. That meant that they had complete return, 100% return of the range of motion. All the pain and inflammation was gone in their fingers and toes and hips and knees and their neck. And certainly, many of them still had knots on their fingers because it was only 90 days. And you'd think they'd call me up, these professors, of medicine from Harvard Medical School and from the Boston VA, and say, look, Wallach, we have to apologize to you. We've been bad-mouthing you for 20 years. And why don't you come up to Boston? Let's talk about the whole thing. Here's what they said. Quote, after 3 months, it was clear that the drug was beneficial, unquote. Chicken cartilage had become a drug in 90 days. Now, why would that happen? Well, because you can't patent chicken cartilage. And they convinced at the U.S. Patent Office that they were using a drug to do this study. And they actually got a use patent on chicken cartilage. And you too, for $3,500 a month, can get Harvard Medical School's chicken cartilage in a capsule for arthritis. Of course, cartilage has chondroitin sulfate in it, glucosamine sulfate, collagen. These are all the basic raw materials to rebuild cartilage and bone. Now again, I've been telling my human patients this for 20 years. We've been using cartilage for racehorses for 100 years for their cartilage and ligaments and joints. And in 1995, Luke Bucci, an exercise physiologist, came out with a great book called Pain Free, and he talks about the advantages of cartilage and glucosamine sulfate and chondroitin sulfate and collagen for regrowing cartilage, ligaments, tendons, connective tissue, bone foundation, bone matrix. Does this with nutrition. Does it with glucosamine sulfate and chondroitin sulfate and collagen in cartilage. Just a couple of months ago, a medical doctor, Dr. Jason Theodosakis, MD, wrote The Arthritis Cure. Subtitle, The Medical Miracle That Can Halt, Reverse, and May Even Cure Osteoarthritis. The last medical cacao we want to look at before we get into the longevity stuff is exercise. How many of you have ever heard that exercise is good for you? Yeah, you're asleep at the wheel if you haven't heard that one. Well, if that were true, people who exercise should live longer than people who are couch potatoes, right? The average couch potato in America lives to be 75.5. The average athlete, depending on the sport and the level of competence, lives to be 62 to 68. So there's something wrong with this theory that exercise alone is good for you. I want you to think about Jim Fix, who died in 1984 at age 52. Jim Fix was running 10 miles a day from the early 60s, believing that if you ran 10 miles a day, 7 days a week, you'd live to be over 100. And he refused to take vitamins and minerals because he believed that he would muddy the water, and he wanted to prove that it was the exercise that helped you live to be over 100. When he was 52 years old, he had 5 cardiomyopathy heart attacks, 5 selenium deficiency heart attacks in his 52nd year. The 5th one killed him. When they did the autopsy on Jim Fix, you know, when they open you up, they take a little scissors and they open up all your arteries like little tubes, and they said, gosh, his arteries as clean as a newborn baby's. But he had a huge technical problem. His heart was dead. Doesn't matter how clean your arteries are. If your heart's dead, it doesn't matter, does it? Then you look at people like Jesse Owens, won 4 gold medals in track and field in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, died at age 66. The Flying Finns, who were the Olympic team for track and field for Finland during the 20s and 30s, they dominated 3 Olympics in a row, won most of the gold, most of the silver, almost all the bronze medals during those 3 Olympics, 2 in the late 20s and in the first Olympics in the 30s. They dominated everybody. None of them lived to be 70 years of age. Well, here's the last one on exercise before we get into the longevity stuff. Dr. Michael P. Ortiz, 38 years old, was also a runner, and this guy ran all through junior high and high school and college and medical school. And when he graduated, he still loved exercise and believed it was good for you. And he tried to carry this love of exercise to his patients, and he gave them a 10% discount on his medical services if they would run with him 2 weeks out of every month. And on this particular fateful day, Dr. Michael P. Ortiz, 38 years old, was jogging with a big group, you know, gallery of his patients, kind of like Forrest Gump, running down this road with this huge gallery of patients. And he collapsed and died in front of his horrified patients, and it was billing week. Now, nobody stopped to give him CPR because they didn't want to lose that 10% discount on his services. Now, if you do everything right, how old can you live to be? Is it worth all the effort? I believe it is. Here's one. Christian Mortensen from San Rafael, California, in August of 1995, turned 113. August of 1996, he turned 114. He's still going strong. Certainly can live to be 115. Smokes a couple of cigars a day like George Burns, who also lived to be over 100. Certainly was, I guess, the only exercise George Burns ever did was put the cigars in his mouth. This gal here, Dora Ramathebe from South Africa, in July of 1995, turned 114. And when she was asked by the media, Dora, what do you attribute your health and longevity to? She did not say that we owe it all to our annual physical or our HMO. She said, I ate locust every day. You know, a little grasshopper. She's not a vegetarian. She eats little animals. Pumpkin seeds, tortoise meat, wild herbs, dried fruit, and starts each day with a cup of coffee. This gal here, Margaret Skeets from Radford, Virginia, in 1994, was the oldest documented living American when she died at age 115. Fell over and fractured her hip. 3 weeks later, she was dead from complications of osteoporosis, a simple calcium deficiency. And we'll talk more about this in a minute. Unfortunately, this is not unusual. 75% of all Americans over the age of 65 who fracture a hip or major leg bone don't live 90 days. They die of pneumonia, pulmonary embolism, stroke, and other complications of that fracture. Susie Brunson, according to her family, in December of 1994, was the oldest American when she died at age 123. And they based their claim on her birth date, December 25th, 1870, which is recorded in the family Bible. And this fellow here, Francisco Barrasnueva Chaparina, October 1995. He was from a little town outside of Bogota, Colombia, turned 125. When he was asked by the media, Francisco, what do you attribute your health and longevity to? He said, well, I drink a gallon of goat's milk every day. Also, it's kind of fascinating in his birthday announcement. This is not an obituary. This is a birthday announcement. Said that over 40 years ago, his physicians told him he only had a couple of months to live, so he had his sons build him a coffin, and he's been waking up every morning for more than 40 years, sitting by that coffin, waiting to die. Good night time comes, he goes to bed, wakes up the next morning, sits by the coffin, waits to die. Now, he's still going strong, and all the doctors who told him that more than 40 years ago are long since dead. Now, this fellow here, Hamoudi El Abdullah from Syria, July of 1993, about, 3.5 years ago, died at age 133, and he was still fathering children after the age of 100. He remarried for the 4th time when he was age 80, fathered 4 boys, 5 girls, 9 children after the age of 80 with the same wife, and you add up the pregnancies and the breastfeeding, the time in between pregnancies, he was still fathering children after the age of 100. Now, this very next one is my very, very favorite. This gal, Mazumi Dusti from Iran, according to the Rocky Mountain News Wire Services out of Denver and the Iranian News Agency, this was January of 1995, a little over 2 years ago. She died at age 161. Now, you have to give a certain amount of credibility to this obituary report that she died at age 161 because she was survived by six living children ranging in age from 120 to 128. They hadn't even left home to go to college yet. Now, her oldest son, Golam, said his mother had never visited a doctor nor taken any chemical medications during her life, did take a few herbs. So if you kind of think about it, every one of these people who lived to be over 100, 120, 130, 160, these people are not from the United States or Canada or Germany or England. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Most of them are from third world countries. They're furthest away from medical help, and they live to be old. So we're beginning to collect information here. The last one we want to look at, the National Geographic Society, a very respected group of people, scientists and so forth, and support groups for science, comes out with a monthly magazine, the National Geographic magazine, of course. And they, in January of 1973, 24 years ago, came out with a nifty special issue on longevity. They looked at about 10 cultures whose peoples routinely live to be 120 to 140. And they documented the oldest living human being that they could find based on their criteria. This fellow, by the name of Shirali Mizmalov from Azerbaijan, a little country just south of Russian Georgia in western Russia today, they documented him as being 167 years old. Remember, this is the National Geographic Society, not the National Enquirer. 167 years of age, and they had a half-page picture of him actually harvesting tea leaves in a tea plantation, still working 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, when he's 167. 5 months later, May of 1973, Shirali Mizmalov turns 168, goes out and hoes the garden for reporters to show how vigorous he is at age 168. Now, all this is just to prove to you that human beings do have the genetic capacity to live to be 120 to 140. People do it all the time. Unfortunately, Americans don't do a very good job. Our average lifespan is 75.5, half we're genetically capable of. So we need to look at why. What's going on here? What can we do to fix this?